Part 1. United States and Europe. Chapter 1. The Bike and the Motorcycle. Conversion, like wisdom, takes a lifetime. Scott McKnight, The Jesus Creed. At 3 a.m, my mother softly nudged my shoulder to wake me up. Bleary-eyed, I got out of bed and grabbed my clothes, trying not to rouse my younger brother John, sleeping next to me. 40 minutes later, I was pedaling my red Schwinn bicycle through the cool morning air to pick up a bundle of newspapers from the gas station on Highway 51, a few blocks from my home. I'd been delivering papers for a year, and now, at 14, I had a good routine. I would pack as many papers as I could, about 120, into bags slung over my small frame, fill the basket on the front and the double baskets on the rear of my bicycle, and make the journey to where my paper route started in the Fraser area of Memphis, Tennessee. The more papers you delivered, the more money you could earn, and the only way to increase this income would be to have a motorcycle. I liked the small Honda, the one my friend Dennis had. Dennis could deliver over 200 papers, finishing early and making more money than me. I knew my dad would never allow it. He was very clear. I was not even allowed to ride a motorcycle, let alone operate one. This was before helmet laws were introduced in our city. My father had been a medic in the Army and had later worked as an ambulance driver. He had seen too many injuries and deaths from motorcycles to allow his sons to ride them. I knew enough to let it go. I met Dennis that morning at the gas station, and he said he would come over to help me finish my route. We would then go back to his house and sleep for a couple of hours before going out to enjoy our summer break from school. It was July 15th, 1965, the day before my dad's 46th birthday. I was tired that morning and was looking forward to finishing my route and getting a little sleep at Dennis's house. I heard the sound of his motorcycle coming down the road. "Hey, hand me some papers," he shouted. I gratefully passed over my last ones for the remaining houses. In no time, all the newspapers were delivered, and Dennis came back to meet me. "I'll follow you home," I said, knowing he would get back to his house faster than I would. "Why don't you just leave your bike here and hop on the back?" he suggested matter-of-factly. This made sense. It would be so much quicker, I reasoned. But all of a sudden, I heard my dad's voice in my head. "Son, I don't want you riding motorcycles." What should I do? I thought. I stifled a yawn. I was exhausted. Desire for sleep won out. I ignored my conscience and disobeyed my dad. He'd never even know, right? Grabbing my empty bags, I left my bike behind a fence and jumped on behind Dennis as he revved the engine and pulled away. We were nearly home when we saw the 50-passenger Memphis City bus. To turn right onto an intersecting road, the driver had to make a wide, sweeping left turn on the narrow S-curve in the road. As the driver came to our side of the street, Dennis tried to swerve right to get out of the way of the bus. Instead, the motorcycle hit some loose gravel in the center of the intersection and started sliding. As Dennis was slowly braking, leaning to the right to avoid hitting the bus head-on, the back end of the motorcycle, where I was sitting, rotated closest to it. As if in slow motion, I slipped off the back of the motorcycle, terrified. I was headed straight under the bus and passed out on impact. The back double wheels ran over the right side of my torso, hip, and thigh. The brakes screeched as the bus driver realized a human body was under his vehicle. Because the driver thought the wheels were still on top of me, he reversed the bus, running back over my leg, tearing up my body as the weight of the wheels crushed my right leg from knee to pelvis. Dennis escaped uninjured. As I regained consciousness, I was lying on the street next to the back wheels of the bus, people standing over me. The first thing I remember was the sound of Dennis's mother's voice, We were only a few hundred yards from Dennis's home. "He's dead! He's dead!" she screamed. I remember thinking, I can't be dead, if I can think. At the same time, I was crying out in pain, losing a lot of blood. I just wanted someone to lift my head up off the ground so I could see what had happened to me. When eventually someone did lift my head, I passed out from shock at what I saw. An ambulance arrived, and I was rushed to the hospital. My dad worked nights for a trucking company, and my mother had been waiting for the very bus that ran over me. She was on her way to work as a bookkeeper at a wholesale company on Main Street in Memphis. When the bus did not arrive, she had walked back home and asked my older brother David to drive her to work. Later, it was David who took the call from the hospital and contacted Mom and Dad to tell them what had happened. My parents came to the hospital as soon as they received the news. When I regained consciousness, I was lying on an emergency room bed, my father standing over me with tears streaking his face.
"Sorry, Dad. Please don't be mad at me. I'm really sorry. Will you forgive me for riding on that motorcycle?"
I said weakly. "Sure, son," Dad replied, taking my hand and giving it a squeeze. "Is there anything I can get for you?" he asked. I thought for a moment and said,
"Dad, I'm so thirsty. Could you get me a big Pepsi Cola and a candy bar?"
My dad, holding back his tears, tried to calm and assure me. But he knew I was in critical condition and what was ahead of me. He had seen many similar life-threatening accidents during his days as an Army medic. I was taken to surgery as soon as the doctors stabilized me and replenished my blood loss. My dad later told me he had asked the team, led by General Surgeon Shael Sheinberg, urologist Joseph Orman, and orthopedic surgeon Leo Hay, what the chances of saving my leg were. "We have to save his life first," the doctors had said grimly. Each doctor came to Mom and Dad over the next few hours, not to give them hope, but to update them on my condition. The first surgery lasted 5 hours. Dad asked Dr. Sheinberg not to keep anything from the family. He also told the doctor that scores of people were praying, that they had put me fully into the hands of God, and that they trusted him for a miracle. Dr. Sheinberg could only reply, "Your son is in very critical condition." I was in intensive care for 2 weeks, and my parents did not know from day to day whether I would survive. The huge loss of blood threatened to end my life. My pelvis was fractured in 3 places. My bladder was displaced several inches from its normal position, and the urethra was torn loose from it. The mutilation of my right thigh from the hip to the kneecap would require removal of sections of the quadriceps muscles. Grit, dirt, and sand had fused into the area so deeply that the doctors had to cut away infected flesh, making suturing of the thigh impossible. 3 times I returned to the operating room for removal of infected flesh. My doctors had differing views on the course of treatment. A few of them believed that amputation of my leg was necessary to save my life, while others thought getting the thigh infection under control could save my life and my leg. I underwent 6 surgeries in 3 months. I was confined to a special circular electric bed with a striker frame that rotated 360 degrees, slowly enabling my fractured pelvis to bear body weight, allowing movement to prevent bed sores, and aiding nurses and orderlies who tried to rotate me without touching or lifting. The surgeries included skin grafts, with skin taken from my left thigh and my chest. The smell of freshly transferred skin on my injured leg was sickening, as was the antiseptic smell of the iodine. Because nothing could touch my grafted skin as it healed,
A cage was placed over my body with the blanket on top of that. A heat lamp was put under the blanket to dry out the skin. My doctors were worried about the additional infection and prescribed strong intravenous antibiotics. At one point, two bags were taken straight from a cold refrigerator and hooked up to my IV. My whole body began shivering violently, as if my blood had turned to ice. Once my body could tolerate the weight of blankets, I must have had a dozen of them on top of me. But it seemed to make no difference. My lips turned blue, and I wondered if I would ever feel warm again. "He can't take this," my dad said, trying to reason with the nurses, who insisted I needed the antibiotics, but allowed my dad to take the second bag from the fridge and place it on the windowsill for the sun to warm it a bit. That didn't help much. Each night in the hospital, Mom would rub my feet, and then when I could not take the pain any longer, she would call the nurses to give me a shot of pain medication. Only then could I fall into a fitful sleep. This pattern went on for my entire hospital stay. I was finding recovery slow and difficult, and often cried because of the intense pain and the frustration of being confined to bed for so long. My room was on the third floor of the hospital. I was able to look out the window and see children in a park playing sports, running and jumping. "I won't ever be able to do that again," I told myself as I wept alone in my room. I thought my life was over, and I didn't know how long I could stand the constant pain. Many people were unable to see me in this condition and thus could not visit me. Just after the accident, one of the pastors from my church, Jerry Sandage, visited me. He left shocked and ill at the sight and smell of my mangled body and was moved to compassion by the amount of my pain. Leaving the hospital, he returned to the church just as the choir was beginning their weekly practice. Interrupting the singing, he told them about me. "We have to pray for this boy right now," he said. He told me later he'd felt sure there was a battle going on for my life, and that through prayer, the church was willing to fight for me. My family prayed for my recovery night and day. My mother spent every night at my side. My father stayed with me during the daytime. My parents were both Christians and trusted God for my life, but it was one of the most difficult times of their lives. As the weeks went by, it looked like I wasn't going to lose my leg. Slowly, I began to show improvement. "We'll have you walking out of this hospital," Dr. Scheinberg said, pleased with my progress. In 1965, skin grafts had a 50% success rate. But 100% of the skin that was transplanted onto my leg lived. Dr. Scheinberg told my father that he knew people were praying because he felt someone else in the operating room helping and guiding him as they worked on my body. In the last month of my hospital stay, I was moved from the circular bed to a regular one. I continued rehab, began whirlpool baths, and started to move around in a wheelchair. While lying in bed for 2 months, I had lost a lot of muscle strength. During my first trip in the hallway, I was able to move about 40 yards, but I was so tired that the nurse had to wheel me back to the room. However, the more I got up and moved in the chair, the more my strength came back. I also had a tutor, since I was missing the first weeks of high school. I was eventually wheeled out of the hospital in mid-October and given an aluminum walker to help me get around. This didn't work well in our small home, however. Because the walker banged into door jams and made movement difficult, I graduated to crutches pretty quickly. My dad tried to encourage me, saying over and over, "Stevie, it's a miracle you are alive. God saved your life. You can trust him."
He saved your life for a reason. Ask him what he wants you to do. At one point in Dad's life, when he was a soldier in Korea, he had thought about being a missionary or being in full-time Christian service of some kind. That never worked out, however, and Dad did not want me to miss anything God had for me. I knew he was right. This was a miracle. God had spared my life, and I wanted to know what his plan for me was. For 2 weeks, I used crutches to get around our house and then started to ride my bike to school. I tried to walk as normally as I could without limping and without the use of the crutches. All I wanted was to be normal like everybody else. I'd lost all feeling above my right knee and thigh and would often hit my leg on some object and not realize the damage until I saw the blood seeping through my trousers. I had a lot of physical therapy to get stronger and more flexible. It seemed like I had grown a foot that summer while confined to a hospital bed. Improvements came day by day. And when I went back for a checkup, Dr. Scheinberg didn't recognize me. I walked into his office with hardly a limp. Even though I was confident and popular in school, after the accident I became more self-conscious about my appearance. My body was a patchwork of lighter and darker skin from the grafts. If I was swimming or wearing shorts, children would come up to me and ask, "Wow, what happened to your leg and your chest?" They were fascinated with my story of the motorcycle, and children still are. They are not afraid to ask questions and to inquire about my scars. Despite being saved from death, I had not discovered my purpose in life and had questions about giving my life to God. I was independent, and my perceptions of God and questions about him affected my trust in him. It somehow seemed safer to try to control my life, even when it went horribly wrong. I did not yet understand that this humble creator of the universe died so that I could be free, that he was loving, kind, and faithful to 1,000 generations, that he was patient, and that true love does not force itself on any of us. God simply waits. I enjoyed playing basketball, baseball, and tennis, and really did not have much time for God in my remaining years of high school, even though I went to church on Sundays. Those close to me often reminded me that God had saved my life for a reason, without saying, "Maybe you should figure out what his purpose is." I was starting to listen to the words of my peers, rather than what I felt were narrow do's and don'ts of those in authority. Whenever my parents, my grandmother, my two older brothers, or other authority figures suggested or told me what I should do, I struggled with their perspective and thus struggled to obey. I was independent, strong-willed, and resistant. But somehow, I stayed out of serious trouble. My family attended First Assembly of God, Memphis, the same church Elvis Presley attended once or twice a year. Church was about 25 minutes from our home. At the end of our street was a little Baptist church, a congregation where a girl named Marie Bentley worshipped. On the Sunday after my accident, Marie had heard about me from a friend who had been riding the bus that hit me, and she had been praying for my recovery. Little did either of us know at the time that the boy for whom she was praying would one day serve God and others with her on the other side of the world.